Ellen Bravo's new novel, Again and Again, deals with an issue that's been very much in the news lately, campus date rape. A longtime activist, Ellen is the former director of 9 to 5, a national organization fighting for justice for working women. She currently heads Family Values at Work, a network of state coalitions working for family-friendly policies. Ellen is the award-winning writer of 3 nonfiction books, the most recent being Taking on the Big Boys, or Why Feminism is Good for Families, Business, and the Nation. She received the Frances Perkins Intelligence and Courage Award in 2011. Ellen, thanks so much for joining us on Women's Magazine.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So you've written 3 nonfiction books in your field of expertise, which, as I just said, is workplace issues and economic justice. Is Again and Again your first novel?
It's not the first novel I've written. It's just the first novel that's been published.
Why did you choose to focus on date rape rather than, say, workplace issues?
I don't choose a topic for a novel. It comes to you. It seizes you. And this one was inspired by several things that happened with people that I knew. But it also, when I worked at 9 to 5, we did a lot of work on sexual harassment. Earlier in my life, I did some work on a domestic violence coalition. So it's not, the issue isn't new to me, and I see a lot of overlaps. For example, today our groups fight for paid sick and safe days because we know that people who experience domestic and sexual violence need time not just to heal but to take action, go seek shelter, to take legal action, and that's included in the time that we're fighting for. So one of the things I hoped the book will spark, and it certainly has already with people that have contacted me, is an affirmation that this is an injury and it's really harmful. And it not only is the person who experienced it often blamed for getting herself in that situation in the first place, quote unquote, but also there's such minimalization of the nature of that injury and the consequences of it. And, you know, one woman who wrote a blurb for the book, she's part of the group Know Your Nine that organizes on campuses against sexual assault. And she said it confronts what happens when young rapists grow up to be powerful men.
Yeah, so the central action of the book takes place in 1979 at an elite Northeastern college. But the story does go back and forth between that period and 2010 when the rapist is running for the Senate. So why 1979 and why switch back and forth between that time period and 2010?
I wanted the original assault to happen before there was any research that really validated the concept of acquaintance rape or date rape. Some seminal work was done in 1985 that got reported in Ms. Magazine. It was a real turning point. And I wanted to show how much harder that made it for Liddy, Deborah's roommate, that there was no one in the therapy world that really understood what she was going through.
So, I mean, it's really kind of amazing to me to think of 1979, which were my college years. I was a junior in college then. You know, that as a time really before the concept of acquaintance rape had even been written about in a major women's organ like Ms.
There were women's groups obviously talking about violence against women and talking about rape earlier than that in the 70s. And as you saw in the novel, one of Deborah's professors uses the term date rape. There were people who had already understood that concept. But it was very little attention was being paid, and certainly not by university administrations.
So one of the characters, Liddy, the survivor, actually says, and this is in 2010, not enough has changed between then and now to make it seem safe for her to tell what she knows about what this man did. How much do you think our understanding and our treatment of date rape and acquaintance rape has changed?
In some ways a lot, and in other ways not at all. So the good thing is that there's much more action by the federal government. For example, there's at least 100 universities that are being investigated. People are using Title IX as a wonderful lever to make sure that universities are held accountable. There's a lot of organizing going on by groups like Know Your Nine and A Long Walk Home and Hollaback and many others, both on campuses, but also, you know, this also happens obviously in high school and in communities. So those are all good things, and I think there's a lot more. You know, when you get a best-selling author like John Krakauer, even though he acted as if he, you know, just discovered the topic, but he also writing a best-selling book about a small town college date rape situation, and lots more people are being exposed to it. That's a good thing. On the other hand, we still live in a country that has a very prevalent rape culture. The prep school rape trial that just happened was a good reminder of this, of how common it is for there to be boasting for what is in fact rape to be described as slaying and scoring, and to have gone on for decades without any intervention, anybody paying attention to it. The Old Dominion banners that greeted students when they started school this year, drop your freshman daughter off here, we'll take moms too, as if that were a joke. I mean, it just reminds us how much work still remains to be done.
Yeah, and I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned that trial, because what hit me in the coverage is that, and maybe this is just how I read it, but that the balance of opinion is still that the woman is lying, or
absolutely,
that she needs to really prove that she didn't want it.
That's right.
And of course, it's almost impossible to prove that. I mean, you can't really prove what your state of mind was.
The burden of proof still remains with the survivor to show that she didn't entice it, want it, and instigate it, and, you know, and is the one who has to prove that she's not lying. But more and more, there are groups coming together to give each other support to fight this and to change. As you know, in most universities, the level of scrutiny is preponderance of evidence rather than beyond a reasonable doubt, as it was in that courtroom. And that makes it easier to prove. And I think we'll see a lot more emphasis on prevention and assessment and gauging the college campus culture. Those are things that will be a huge improvement. There has been very little attention given to that. And also that we'll see more training of people who take complaints and investigate them. But above all, I hope what we'll see is many more programs devoted to not to tell young women how not to get raped, but how to tell young men what they can't get away with, and particularly, since it's not the majority of men who do it, how to stop being bystanders, how to stop in any way encouraging the culture. All the boys that rushed to that Owen Labdy's room to congratulate him on his conquest are just as guilty, and that needs to change, and people need to wake up to that and say, wow, I never thought of it that way. I never imagined I was playing that role. And I think we'll see a lot more. There's some great programs, A Call to Men, a group called Be That Guy, and that's what they're calling men to do, is to intervene so that it's not just on women not only to avoid being raped but to stop rape from happening. And I think we'll see greater emphasis on this in the coming years.
I'm always ambivalent about the organizing for sort of harsher penalties for men who commit rape on campus, or, you know, for zero tolerance, or yes means yes legislation that, you know, colleges can lose their funding if they're not doing enough to prosecute or to address rapes that occur on their campus, because, you know, to ensure that all sex that happens is consensual. Because I worry that the dominant paradigm has become so set by the carceral state, you know, and the tough on crime legislation, that without intending it, some of the policies that feminists are promoting end up simply reinforcing the inequitable treatment of the criminal justice system, that the men right. who end up being expelled or even prosecuted, you know, for having sex without making absolutely sure that all the I's are dotted, you know, end up being disproportionately men of color, low-income men. What about that?
I think groups like Know Your Nine share that concern, and that's why their emphasis is not on the, certainly not criminalizing and turning it over to police. That is not what they want. And their emphasis is much more on prevention and culture change and making sure that there are, that there's research done that can be measured about the effectiveness of programs. You know, so often you can imagine the money that's being made by consultants saying, pick me, I'll show you how to stop this. And again, a lot of the programs are directed at teaching women how not to be raped. And what the groups like Know Your Nine and others are asking for is a really different approach. I feel like that's what we want. We want systemic change. We don't just want more consequences, although we do want people to know they can't get away with this, and we do want universities to know we're watching and that they will be held accountable. You know, there's been a resistance among a lot of administrations. They'll say, it is a problem, but not here. And we need, and they're so worried that alumni or prospective parents will see any report of statistics on sexual assault as a deterrent to coming that they don't want to know. And much better for them to have transparency and to say, this is how we ensure safety of our students and ensure that all of them can learn, is by setting up these conversations and prevention programs and so on. And, you know, I'm really hoping that again and again my novel can be part of that effort. I feel like it can spark a lot of good conversations.
So most of the main characters in your book are well-educated white women. One of the protagonists is from a working-class rural background. There's one major African-American character, and she's the fierce sidekick of Deborah, the main character who, as you said, is the director of a national anti-violence organization. So in setting up those roles in that way, did you worry about reinforcing stereotypes about who feminism is for and who feminists are and the racial dynamics within feminism?
You know, I was very mindful when I was writing this book, and I've actually written an essay about it called Writing While White, of the importance of addressing race, even if the main characters are white. And because of who the perpetrator is and where he went to college and who he would have interacted with, it was kind of inevitable that the survivor was going to be white and that her roommate at the time would have been white. But for me, Marquita is absolutely not a sidekick, and so one of the ways I addressed it was to have her name that phenomenon, that there were certain people on the board of directors of their nonprofit who saw her as not having agency in her own right and just existing to do whatever Deborah needed. And in fact, just the opposite. She has a lot of agency. She's very smart. She really guides the organizing that takes place overall in the organization together with Deborah. But in particular, she's the one who comes up with a plan for how they deal with this situation. And so I dealt with it a couple of ways. One is, this is an organization like many that has a struggle going on between two different visions. The one that Marquita and Deborah share is that the group should be what the Black Lives Matter people call a leaderful movement. I love that term. And the leaders are mostly young women and mostly women of color. And that the focus should be on grassroots organizing out in the field, versus a view that the focus should be on the D.C. office and the brand of the national organization and one leader. So I tried to address it in those ways. I tried to just the realities of the disparate impact of sexual violence on women of color in many ways throughout the book. I think those are all, you know, really important questions. questions. And I'm also trying in my book tour and on my Facebook page, as I think all white women who deal with the issue of rape need to address the not in my name problem when a white supremacist in Charleston massacres black men and women in the name of protecting white women from rape. We have to say, not in our name, this is not what the anti-violence, anti-rape movement wants and is trying to accomplish, and don't you dare use it that way. So the other day, the same day of the Owen LaBrie verdict, was the 60th anniversary of the murder, brutal murder of 14-year-old Emmett Till for whistling at a white woman. And I wrote about that. I think that's the raising awareness of that is part of the work that we need to do.
You know, as an activist and a writer, sometimes I feel like there's a unbridgeable tension between writing and activism, finding time for writing and finding time for activism, because activism is so immediate and, you know, writing such a long game. Even if you feel like your work is, your writing is in the service of activism, it can be so hard to get it out there. How do you balance your writing and your activism?
You know, it's hard to describe. I just take sneak time whenever I can. I think of it a little bit that way. I try to block out time, you know, in the same way that in my schedule, I schedule going to the gym. Every day I make a work plan, and every day it includes time for working out. And I try also to block out time to write. You know, I write on vacations. I write on weekends. It's something I can't live without doing. As an activist, I've always fought hard for people to have full lives that include activism, but also include time for their friends and their loved ones and taking care of themselves and for culture and art. So, and to me, it's the strength of a movement when you build it to engage as many people as possible so that no one has to live 24 hours on call, and so that many people become leaders and many people find avenues and ways to become engaged. And particularly when you work with low-wage women, you have to have, for people who have very little time and no money, you have to have many ways that people can enter a movement and have their voices matter. I learned a long time ago that if you work like a maniac, the people you're trying to organize will say, thank you for what you do, but I can't do it because I have my family and I have other things in my life. So we have to make the work happen in such a way that we ourselves can have time for other things too.
Ellen Bravo is the author of Again and Again. She's also the head of the Family Values at Work Coalition. You might have seen her a couple weeks ago on Melissa Harris Perry talking about why everyone needs paid sick leave. You have a chance to see her talk more about her novel, Again and Again, and the issues it raises with members of Know Your Nine and the Women Donors Network next Saturday, September 26th, from 7 to 9 p.m. at Book Passage in Corte Madera. She'll also be at UC Berkeley at an event co-hosted by Student Government Commission on Sexual Assault and the Restaurant Opportunities Center United, two groups you don't always see on the same program. That's Monday the 28th from 5 to 8 p.m. You can get the specifics on both of those Bay Area events on Ellen's website, ellenbravo.com, and that's also where you can find out how to order the book, which I do recommend. And we will have those links on our blog, kpfawomensmag.blogspot.com, and our website, kpfa.org/program/women's-magazine. You're listening to Women's Magazine on KPFA 94.1 FM, online at kpfa.org. I'm Kate Raphael, back in a minute with Diana Block to talk about her new novel, Clandestine Occupations. Don't go away.
Dear, I need you to hear. I cannot disappear. I've tried again and again and again and again. I know we said